Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
This week on RealityCast, we'll have an interview about the International AIDS Conference with a representative from Guttmacher, another installment about the ongoing war on contraception, and a break from the heavy stuff by mocking the sexist dating advice on the Tyra Banks show. Also, a taste of a phone message left by the worst person alive. Thanks to everyone who agreed to be in our Man on the Street interviews at Netroots Nation. Here's a sample.
I do consider myself pro-choice. I think the right to have an abortion is something that's up to the woman, and isn't something that the government should be legislating.
I definitely consider myself pro-choice. I mean, it's one of the basic, liberties that people have. Is this, women have to have control over their own bodies.
As is traditional on these podcasts, I have a couple of requests for listeners to help get out the word about RH Reality Check. First of all, go to realitycheck.org to sign up for a daily email summarizing the news in reproductive rights that day. Also, if you could go to the dig page linked from the transcript page of this show and dig the podcast, I'd be most grateful. It really helps drive listeners to the podcast if it gets high enough in rankings. Now, more news on the ongoing and mostly underground war on contraception. And when I say mostly underground, I mean it's becoming more and more above ground, probably because anti-choicers feel that they're really close to being able to push harder on this issue. One big initial issue is the fallout from John McCain being caught on video unwilling to say anything positive about contraception, and certainly unwilling to say that it's unfair for insurance companies to cover Viagra but not contraception. Of course, the right-wing surrogates jumped up to take it a step further and try to push Americans to the right on this issue, arguing that contraception should become controversial again, instead of just a normal part of life. Bill O'Reilly, functioning under his usual belief that women aren't quite human beings, led the brigade.
On a similar subject, the Planned Parenthood fanatics want you and me to pay for everybody's birth control, so they use John McCain to make that point. Okay, listen up. Viagra is used to help a medical condition. That's why it's covered. Birth control is not a medical condition. It is a choice. Why should I or anybody else have to pay for other people's choices? Do I have to buy you dinner before you use the birth control? Give me and every other taxpayer a break, Planned Parenthood.
In other words, men having sex is a medical necessity, but women having sex are just sluts trying to get away with something. The irony of this is that the worst thing that can happen to a man who doesn't have Viagra, medically speaking, is that he doesn't have intercourse and an orgasm. For a woman who is designed access to birth control, the medical effects can be hypertension, weight gain, searing pain, surgery, and even death. So O'Reilly thinks that a woman dying is less of a medical problem than a man having to skip the sex once in a while. That's an unvarnished double standard, though I have no doubt O'Reilly would bristle if you called him sexist. And who are these men that need sex supposed to be having sex with if women aren't supposed to be having sex? Each other? I suppose that's a solution, but not one that I would expect a homophobe like O'Reilly to understand. Maybe he thinks Viagra is so you can get an erection to waggle at other men to show that you can do it, but not actually used for sexual intercourse. The good news is that McCain's squirmy moment means that the anti-contraception agenda of the far right is getting more mainstream media attention. Chris Hayes and Rachel Maddow talked about it on MSNBC.
When pressed by that reporter, Maeve Reston of the LA Times, who, by the way, deserves some kudos here, when pressed by Reston on whether it was fair that some insurance companies cover erectile dysfunction meds but not birth control, McCain answered, quote, "It's something that I had not thought much about," and yet he voted on it in the U.S. Senate. Is the big headline here that a senator admits to not bothering to even think about things he nevertheless votes on?
Well, it's funny. This is actually kind of a John McCain tick. He does this fairly often. In fact, there was an article, I want to say it was in the New Republic, in which he talked about this. And reporters like it the first time they encounter it or the second time they encounter it because it seems so kind of frank. He says, well, you know, I actually don't know that much about that, or I can't really remember that vote. And it seems kind of like a breath of fresh air because it's honest. But he does it enough time, you start to think, well...
So that's some good media attention. I wish, however, that more attention was paid to why McCain is doing this little dance around an issue that is relatively popular, which is insurance coverage for birth control, which the majority of Americans rely on for a happy, healthy sex life. Or even if they don't need it, many support it on principle. He's doing it to kowtow to an extremist right wing that needs to be exposed for the nut bars they are. Which is why I'm glad to see Hillary Clinton lending her name to an effort to resist the HHS attempt to redefine the birth control pill as abortion under the Bush administration, all in an effort to make it easier for healthcare providers to refuse to provide this basic medical service. Look, they don't really think contraception's abortion so much as they've realized that it's politically easier to turn people on fake abortions than it is to say, as Bill O'Reilly did, that your desire not to get pregnant is irrelevant. Most people don't experience the need to use birth control as irrelevant, nor do most people think of women as subhuman with interests we don't have to care about at all.
The more I learn about these proposed rules by the Bush administration, the more appalled I am and the more determined I am to stop them. This is a gratuitous, unnecessary insult to the women of the United States of America.
I'd like to welcome Heather Boonstra to the program. Heather works for the Guttmacher Institute and is hosting a panel at the International AIDS Conference on meeting the sexual and reproductive health needs of people living with HIV. She's here to talk to us about the conference. Welcome to RealityCast, Heather.
Thank you.
Can you outline some of the themes you expect will be prominent at this year's International AIDS Conference?
Sure. For those who haven't attended this kind of conference before, first of all, it's very large. And we're meeting in Mexico City in August. And it's probably one of the most important global gathering of activists and the science community and governments in the fight against AIDS. And there's a lot of information at this conference, including, you know, release of new data on the AIDS issues and a real gathering place for activists to really share lessons about what they've learned among developed and developing countries, and for activists to share stories about what is happening in their countries.
Well, what are U.S. advocates hoping to accomplish at this year's conference?
Well, I think that the feeling this year is that the field itself is really maturing, and there's been a lot of talk worldwide about the AIDS field moving from a place of urgency and crisis and even an emergency area to a sustained effort over time. And so I think that the feeling going into this year is a little different than conferences in the past, because activists are more on the defensive this year and really having to make the case for why AIDS continues to be one of the number one health and development challenges in the world, and really having to justify resources going into this area in light of the economy and a kind of global recession that seems to be looming. And in fact, we saw this with the most recent G8 conference, where for the first time, first time in a while anyway, we didn't see any pledges toward AIDS coming out of that conference. So even this week, Congress is debating the global AIDS bill, and even there we expect to see amendments on the Senate floor talking about funding and the amount of funding that's going toward the U.S. global AIDS program and whether $50 billion is the right figure. I think, though, on the good side, that going into this AIDS conference, the real debate over prevention versus treatment has really been reconciled over these last few years, and there's really a recognition that prevention and treatment go hand in hand, and there's really no longer arguments I feel, within the AIDS community over, you know, what should come first and what should be a priority. The questions now, though, are about what strategies really work, particularly around prevention, and what works, you know, both at the individual level and at the population level, and how are the best ways to reach people with prevention messages. What we found at Guttmacher in our data and research that we've conducted on young people in HIV prevention is that young people, in any case, worry about both pregnancy and HIV. And in fact, pregnancy may actually be a way of motivating people to do better by way of HIV prevention. I think also, though, at the conference, we'll also hear about who's neglected in the AIDS debate. You know, what groups are most feeling the epidemic, such as men who have sex with men or sex workers and drug users, and how the epidemic is affecting them.
Now, even though we don't consider AIDS, like, say, a crisis like it used to be, does that mean in any way, shape, or form that the epidemic is less of a problem than it used to be?
I don't think it is perceived as less of a problem, but I think that people are nuancing their views of the epidemic as a whole. And rather than talk about, you know, one epidemic worldwide, people are beginning to talk about many epidemics worldwide and really trying to figure out how best to address the epidemic in local regions or countries or areas of the world where the face of AIDS may be slightly different than in other places of the world.
And your panel at the conference, can you outline what your panel will be covering?
Yes, we're hosting a panel on Sunday, August 3 at 3:45, and it's going to be on meeting the sexual and reproductive health needs of HIV-positive people. I think that, you know, this is an area that, as a whole, may see quite a bit of attention at the conference because there are a lot of questions about the relationship of sexual and reproductive health to the AIDS epidemic. And I think for most people, they understand, you know, what is the role of reproductive health or family planning providers in preventing HIV, but there's also the need to meet the needs of people living with HIV with sexual and reproductive health services. For example, many women coming into prevention of mother-to-child transmission programs are themselves, of course, HIV positive and come in with unintended pregnancies or pregnancies that they didn't, you know, want or plan for. And for those women, we really need to make sure that we you know, meet their needs and desires as best that we can. So on our panel, we have really a unique mix of people who are going to be joining us. There are so for those who are attending the conference and want to hear from, you know, people living with HIV, hear about the evidence on integration, hear about the program perspectives and what are some of the challenges that people face on the ground, as well as get an update on global advocacy and an update from Washington, I think they'll be of great interest.
Can you give me a sample of what you're going to be talking about on the panel?
Yeah, so I'll be talking about what is integration, because I think it's a word that we throw out there, but I don't think we have a very good sense of really what it means and what its impact can be on the ground. And I'll also be talking about global advocacy efforts to promote integration and going over some of the worldwide effort and global consensus that has been building over quite a few years on integration. There are new reviews of evidence coming out. There's an assessment tool that the World Health Organization and UNFPA are putting together. So I'll be talking about that global consensus. But then I'll also be talking about some of the challenges to integration worldwide, the way that, you know, taboos around sexuality, the way that the siloed areas of HIV versus sexual and reproductive health have really kept these two areas very separate. And I'll also be talking about the political challenges that there are to fully integrating these two areas.
And just for people in the audience who don't necessarily know the internal battles, can you explain what integration is a little bit more?
Yeah, integration is the linkages between the areas of sexual and reproductive health and HIV. And so in basic terms, it means if you have good sexual and reproductive health, you're likely to have good HIV outcomes. And if you have bad sexual and reproductive health, you're likely to be more at risk of being exposed to HIV. And so integration then is about both encouraging reproductive health providers, family planning providers, to offer sex education, to promote condoms, to test for sexually transmitted disease, and diagnose those and provide treatment on the ground. But it also means HIV programs that specifically service people living with HIV with sexual and reproductive health services. So talking to those folks about their childbearing desires and helping them plan a healthy pregnancy if they desire that, leading them to a place where they can, get family planning and contraceptives if they desire that. For women who are HIV positive and find themselves pregnant when they don't want to be, it's making sure that they have access to options counseling and safe abortion services where those are possible. So it's a broad range of sexual and reproductive health services.
The conference starts on August 3rd. Our guest today is Heather Boonstra from the Guttmacher Institute. Thanks for coming on a Reality Cast, Heather.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now listen up. Now gather around.
Oh my God, I haven't checked over to the Tyra Banks Show's website in a while, and I missed how they've got web exclusives with even more nauseatingly wrong-headed sex and dating advice on it. Most disturbingly, they had this woman named Patty Stanger on giving her own version of the rules for single women. And as you can imagine, they're horrifically bad rules and sexist to boot.
Basically, what my five major commandments that I tell every girl to do is basically to date a pair and a spare. What does that mean? That basically means that when you're dating in the field, you should have three dates a week, especially if one falls out. You always want to have backup. But the first guy is the guy you really, really like. You're waiting for that phone call. Second guy is, you're not sure. He's on the cusp. He's usually somebody that could be a friend, could be a boyfriend. You're not really quite sure. And the third is the guy you know is going to be a friend.
Assumption. You, as a single woman, have nothing to do but date and can devote every last hour on men, no matter how little you like them. Horribly sexist. This assumes that women live for men and men alone. When I was single, I barely had time for three dates a week with someone I was madly in love with, much less a bunch of dudes that I know I don't like, because I have a life and a job and a blog. The assumption is that single women make getting married their career, which doesn't correspond to reality. Her next piece of advice is not to drink too much on dates, which is not bad advice, I guess, but I think she's offering it in bad faith. I think she's offering it because she wants your inhibitions to be up so you can follow this next piece of advice.
And the next thing is no sex. Okay, everybody goes, what do you mean by no sex? It's not no sex forever. It means that you shouldn't have sex unless you're an exclusive, committed relationship. So what does that mean? That means you should be dating someone 90 days to maybe 6 months tops. And if he doesn't ask you to exclusivity in those 6 months, you're not going to sleep with him. That's what you've got as the barter to get in so that he takes you seriously.
Assumption. Women have no sexual desires of their own, but simply view our bodies as currency to exchange for other things. In other words, every woman is a prostitute, except instead of selling your body for money, in this case, you're selling it for a commitment. This belief that women only want commitment and men only want sex, and that relationships only happen after a tense exchange of the two like it's a financial transaction, is what guides abstinence-only education and even anti-choice arguments. See, if we chance getting knocked up every time we have sex, then we won't have sex without the wedding ring and ta-da! Well, that's the only way we'll get married? I think that's the argument. Never mind that most people get married and 95% of Americans have sex before marriage. Maybe, and I know this is crazy feminist talk, a man commits to you because he loves you and wants to be with you. I know, impossible. Even though plenty of experience out there says otherwise. The next piece of advice is good about how you need to be mindful of the fact that you inherit someone's debt when you marry him. But that's why I think that debtor laws probably need to be reconsidered. But it's no wonder that women will marry men that bring all sorts of baggage in an environment where women are told that getting married should be their main and possibly only goal in life. Desperation invades at that point.
Last is marriage. Okay, when you are dating someone you want to get the ring, which every girl wants to get married, you shouldn't date someone for more than a year. Because if he doesn't give you a ring in, let's say, the ninth or even the eighth month of the relationship, he's not taking you seriously.
Every girl wants to get married? Well, I don't. But then again, I call myself a woman, not a girl, so there you go. The idea that you should be announcing your engagement within less than a year of dating someone is the sort of thinking that leads straight to our high divorce rate. You can whine and bemoan our culture where people date for a long time before they get married, but you'll be contending with statistical evidence against you. People are dating longer and marrying later in life, and this is leading to a drop in the divorce rate. The rush to the altar is a quick way of legally binding yourself to someone you don't know very well. Hell, I wasn't even willing to talk about moving in with my boyfriend until we'd been dating a year. What's the harm in going slow and protecting yourself? With her timeline, you probably not even have a chance to figure out if you're sexually compatible before you get married, which is not to say the other compatibility problems that would arise later if you don't know the person you're marrying. And now for the wisdom of wingnuts. A phone message left for a woman met on the street by a professional anti-feminist and pickup artist wannabe, James Sears, got released online.
It's Dimitri calling again, the guy from the street. I left you a message several days ago. You said you were interested. Now, here's the way I work. I don't like leaving second messages, but I like you. You're a very elegant woman. You're very attractive. But, you know, I don't play that game. I know your friends tell you not to return calls. You're playing games like you see on stupid TV shows. So here's how it's going to work. It is now 4:30 on Wednesday. Now, I'll assume that you've already left work because, you know, some people leave early, and I'll grant you that. But if I do not receive a phone call back from you by 3 o'clock Thursday afternoon, I'm no longer interested.
It was so hard to figure out what part to sample from this. The entire thing was just an amazing example of a male entitlement. At no point does he even pause to consider the idea that she's not calling him because he's anything less than the greatest guy on earth. He's bitter and started an anti-feminist cottage industry after his medical license was stripped because he was caught sexually assaulting female patients.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.